Minnesota Public Radio's reports on racial disparity in the criminal justice system are supported in part by the Minneapolis Foundation, a center for giving, connecting resources with opportunities to benefit Minnesota. Good morning. Welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer, and welcome to a special edition of Mid-Morning. This hour, we're going off live to a special Minnesota Public Radio civic journalism broadcast at the University of Minnesota. So let's go now, without further delay, to the University of Minnesota.
Thanks, Catherine. Good morning and welcome. I'm NPR reporter Brant Williams, your host for the next hour at this Minnesota Public Radio Summit. The people gathered here at the University of Minnesota Law School we'll try to answer the question, is there racial bias in the Minnesota criminal justice system? You've heard the stories of racial profiling and the state legislature's struggle to come to terms with it. In Minnesota, the chances of a black man being sent to state prison are almost 25 times greater than a white man's. A lot of people are asking why. Is it simply a matter of more criminal acts by people of color, or does racial bias play a role? These are just a couple of the questions that about 70 citizens, law enforcement officers, judges, lawyers, scholars, and media representatives will be trying to answer today. They have been brought together by the Minnesota Public Radio Civic Journalism Initiative, the Minnesota Journalism Center, and the Institute on Criminal Justice at the University of Minnesota Law School. This hour, we're going to hear from four panelists and then open the floor to the summit participants for questions and comments. During the noon hour, we'll have a major keynote address by David Cole of Georgetown University. For our NPR listeners, if you have something to say about race and the criminal justice system, you can participate on the Internet. Just go to MinnesotaPublicRadio.org and click on our Soapbox Forum. We will give your ideas and stories to the policymakers and opinion leaders who are here today. Our panelists today are Mark Maurer of the Sentencing Project, and he's also the editor of Reducing Racial Disparity in the Criminal Justice System, Barry Feld, a University of Minnesota criminologist specializing in juvenile justice issues, John Powell, executive director of the University of Minnesota's Institute on Race and Poverty, and B. Todd Jones, former U.S. attorney for Minnesota. First, we'll hear from John Powell. Powell is a nationally recognized authority in the areas of civil rights, civil liberties, and issues relating to race, poverty, and the law. He is founder and executive director of the Institute on Race and Poverty here at the University of Minnesota Law School. John will give us some important background information on race and bias in the Minnesota criminal justice system. John Powell.
Thank you, Brian. The question that's posed to us is there bias in the criminal justice system in Minnesota, and what are some of the causes of that if there is? And I guess in the first instance, I would say that question has already been answered. In 1993, the Supreme Court created a task force to ask that very question. And over a study, I think over several years, it found several incidents of bias in the criminal justice system. It actually issued a report, and in that report, it called for 144 changes in the criminal justice system to try to deal with the bias. 94 of those recommendations have been adopted. Now, the thing that spurred this study was the huge disparity in the criminal justice system that you've already made mention of. African-American men are more likely to be incarcerated at a rate of 27 to 1 compared to white men. This disparity between whites and blacks is the greatest in the country. And again, the Supreme Court task force found, in fact, that there was bias. I want to suggest a couple of things. One, the question of bias itself is too narrow. I think, first of all, this disparity should cause all of us to be concerned. If you look at disenfranchisement rates, whites are likely to be disenfranchised from voting at about under 2%, while African Americans are likely to be disenfranchised from voting at about 17%. The disparity itself is huge, and it's not just the criminal justice system. The Institute on Race and Poverty recently issued a study stops by the police officer in St. Paul. We were approached by the St. Paul Police Department to analyze the data that they had collected. There was huge disparities in terms of stops and in terms of searches. And again, these are not criminals. So even to focus on criminals is too narrow. What's going on affects the entire society. It affects all of us. And in this report for the St. Paul Police Department, what we found is that in many instances, the disparity in terms of stops was greatest, not in high crime areas and not in areas where there were large minorities, but in fact in low crime areas where the areas were overwhelmingly white. This suggests to us that this problem is not something that's unique to Minneapolis and St. Paul, but is a Minnesota problem. I moved here about 7 years ago, 8 years ago. I have a teenage son. I was leaving New York. I wanted to be in an area where there were good schools, good amenities, that it was safe for him to grow up and finish high school. After I got here, I was really surprised and alarmed at the huge disparity in the treatment of African Americans generally, but especially African American men. When my son turned 16, he took his driving ed. I wanted to get him a car phone, so if he ever had a problem on the road, he could call me. But then I started looking at what happened to African-American men around the country that had car phones. And there were a number of shootings by police who said that they thought they were reaching for the car phone, they thought they were reaching for a gun. I decided not to get my son a car phone. And I think that's important because what this is really about is not just, again, criminal justice system. It's about African-Americans having to change their lives, having to train our kids, and particularly our sons, differently than whites, basically saying, when the police stop you, this is how you behave, and almost without exception suggesting that, in fact, they will be stopped. So the disparities here are just huge. Now, one of the arguments that you always hear is that, well, the disparities are because African Americans commit more crime. And basically every study that's been done indicates that this is just not the case. If you look at drug offense, for example, which is probably the single leading cause of the disparity in arrests and in convictions, African Americans use drugs at about the same rate, slightly higher, but about the same rates as whites. But in terms of arrests, in terms of prosecution, and in terms of conviction, the difference is huge. So it's not explained in terms of difference in criminal activity, but it's explained in terms of a whole set of patterns that happen throughout our system, not just at the criminal justice system, not just at the policing system, but throughout the system, whether we look at schools, whether we look at housing, whether we look at employment. So in some ways, we should not be surprised. I think sometimes, again, we get into the discussion as to whether or not a particular police officer, a particular judge is a racist. I don't think this is what the issue is really about. I think it's systemic. I think the problems are serious. And I really think it's a question of, will the country ever fully embrace African Americans and other minorities as full citizens? And this kind of bias and this kind of profiling suggests that we still have some work to be done in this regard.
It's fine. Good applause. Thank you, John Powell. John is the Executive Director of the Institute on Race and Poverty here at the University of Minnesota Law School. If you're just tuning in, I'm NPR reporter Brant Williams, host of this special segment of NPR's Mid-Morning Program. We're broadcasting live from the University of Minnesota Law School at a Minnesota Public Radio Civic Journalism Summit entitled, Is There Racial Bias in the Minnesota Criminal Justice System? Mark Maurer is with the Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C. The Sentencing Project monitors incarcerations around the country and looks at racial disparities in the criminal justice system. Mark will tell us what's happening around the rest of the country. Mark?
Thank you very much. I want to try to provide some perspective on the national trends as they may affect what's happening here in Minnesota. And I think we need to look basically over the last 30 years or so, and we find two overlapping trends during this period. First, we see an enormous expansion of the criminal justice system in the last 30 years. It's completely unprecedented in this country and probably that of any democratic nation over this time frame. We now have six times as many people in our prison system as we did 30 years ago, similar increases among people on probation and parole, just historic highs being reached every day. At the same time, we're also seeing an increasing proportion of people of color in the criminal justice system, to the point today nationally where nearly two-thirds of prison inmates across the country are African-American and Latino. So the broad question, of course, is, where does this come from? Is this a function of crime rates, criminal justice policy, bias in the system? And let me just say a bit about what we know about some of those factors. If we look at crime rates, particularly violent crimes, which are more likely to lead to a sentence of incarceration, African Americans nationally are arrested at disproportionate rates. Currently, around 40% of arrests for violent offenses are among African Americans. We also know, if we dig a little bit deeper into those numbers, that much of what might appear at first to be a function of race is really a function of class, that we're receiving is a reflection of poverty, concentrated poverty, and the social disadvantages that come along with that. We also see that we can often see some very significant fluctuations in rates of crime participation in very short periods of time. For example, in the late 1980s, there was a very disturbing spike in black juvenile homicides. Now, we know that much of that was related to the introduction of crack cocaine, initially in urban areas and then spreading. It was related to new drug markets, easy access to guns among young people. But just as we saw that spike in the late 80s, we saw a very significant decline beginning in the 1990s. And again, the decline also was most significant among black juveniles. What happened was that essentially, as has happened many drug epidemics before, young people began looking around at what the destruction was that wrought by crack and decided that didn't seem like very much fun. It didn't seem like a very good lifestyle. Their parents and communities got involved. Police got more sophisticated about tracing the source of illegal guns into communities, and we saw a very significant decline in those high rates of homicide. Now, if we look at criminal justice policies overall, I think over the last 20 years, by far the most significant change we've seen in the system has been the so-called war on drugs and drug policies. In broad terms, we now have 11 times as many people locked up for a drug offense as we did just 20 years ago. We're now approaching 500,000 offenders in prison and jail on a drug offense. And we also see tremendous racial disparities there. In our state prisons, 4 of every 5 inmates incarcerated for a drug offense are African American and Latino, and we do know, as John Powell pointed out, these rates are far out of proportion to the degree that minorities use or sell drugs. So we see some very serious problems, I think, in terms of law enforcement prosecution patterns. Now, the question of bias in the criminal justice system is a complex one, of course. And I think for a start, we need to note that there have been some very significant changes that have taken place in the last 30 years or so. We see much greater diversity of leadership and participation in people of color in the criminal justice system than we did 30 years ago. We see greater engagement with communities by law enforcement and other mechanisms in the criminal justice system, and this is all very positive. At the same time, many of the patterns that we've seen for quite some time still continue, sometimes in more subtle ways than in the past, but they're nonetheless. Racial profiling, of course, the most obvious one. Some people think that racial profiling began 3 years ago on the New Jersey Turnpike, but I think we know that ever since black people have been driving cars, we've had racial profiling. And to their credit, many jurisdictions are now grappling with trying to achieve a balance between appropriate police discretion and finding out when that crosses the line into profiling. We also see, I think, in the justice system, an overlap between questions of race and class and basically access to resources. So we don't always know, is a black person more likely to go to prison than a similarly situated white person because he's black in a particular case or because he's poor? He doesn't have access to a good defense attorney. He can't get into a drug treatment program. He doesn't have a job that might convince a judge to keep him out of prison. These are complex questions, but I think it tells us something about where disparities arise from. Finally, I think much of what we're seeing reflected in the criminal justice system has to do with our national approach to social problems and essentially our approach to the problems of poor people. I think we can see this most clearly in the whole approach to drug policy. We know that drug use and drug abuse cuts across class and racial lines, but drug law enforcement has primarily been focused in inner city areas, and that's why we see the numbers that we see in the prison system. When we look at middle class suburban drug use, we see a system in place that basically is one that relies on families, relies on treatment programs, takes a public health approach to dealing with the problem of substance abuse, and by and large, that's an approach that works very well for most people. When we're talking about urban areas, the approach is one that emphasizes more police, more prisons, and we see a very different path being taken. So it seems to me that some of the assumptions we make about how to approach crime problems and social problems tell us much about what we see in the criminal justice system. Then we're left with practitioners in the justice system having to grapple with the consequences of some of the broader decisions that have been made earlier on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark Maurer. Mark Maurer is with the Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C. The Sentencing Project monitors incarcerations around the country and looks at racial disparities in the criminal justice system. Again, I'm Brant Williams, host of this special segment of NPR's Mid-Morning. We're broadcasting live from an NPR Civic Journalism Summit at the University of Minnesota Law School entitled, Is There Racial Bias in the Minnesota Criminal Justice System? For those of you in our radio audience, you can tell your story or voice your opinion on race and the criminal justice system on the Internet. Just go to our soapbox at minnesotapublicradio.org. Leonard Witt, Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Radio Civic Journalism Initiative, will be sending your ideas to policymakers around the state. It's your chance to be heard at minnesotapublicradio.org. Barry Feld is our third panelist. Feld has written he's written 7 books and more than 50 major articles on criminology. He's a professor here at the University of Minnesota Law School. Professor Feld will give us a little history and background on how it is that we have more people in Minnesota prisons than ever before. Barry Feld.
Thank you. I'm going to talk about the context of race and juvenile justice. And the issue of race has had two distinct and contradictory impacts on juvenile justice law and policy over the past half century. In the 1960s, it was concern about racial discrimination and civil rights that motivated the Supreme Court to require due process in juvenile delinquency proceedings. It was during the 1980s and the 1990s that the increase in youth homicide and the racial characteristics of violent young offenders provided the political incentive to get tough on youth crime, and the crackdown has transformed the juvenile court and disproportionately affected minorities. The due process revolution of the 1960s responded to structural changes associated with race, and particularly the great black migration from the rural South to the urban North in the decades prior to and after World War II. And it was during this half century that blacks moved from being three-quarters rural and southern to being three-quarters urban and more than half in northern cities. It was during the same period that whites began the process of moving to the suburbs and encircled blacks in blighted urban inner-city ghettos. And it was in this context that the Supreme Court's due process decisions were designed to protect the civil rights of minorities and to impose national legal norms on the southern legal caste system. The court's decision in Gault was part of this larger due process revolution, and ironically, by providing juveniles with due process, it began the process of legitimating punishment in the juvenile justice system and fostering a procedural and substantive convergence with criminal courts that has subsequently resulted in heavier sanctions falling disproportionately on minorities. It was also during the 1960s that the baby boom increases in youth crime and urban racial disorder provoked cries for law and order and created divisions within the National Democratic Party between racial and social policy liberals and conservatives, northerners and southerners. Republican politicians seized crime, public welfare, and affirmative action as wedge issues with which to distinguish themselves from Democrats in order to woo white southern voters. During the 1960s, conservative Republicans decried crime in the streets, advocated law and order, and have supported a succession of wars on drugs, on crimes, and on kids. The politicization of crime policy planted the seeds for the crackdown of the 1980s and the 1990s. The crackdown occurred in the context of the deindustrialization of cities in the 1970s and in the 1980s. As we shifted from an industrial to an information and service economy, we saw an economic bifurcation based on skills and education. The migration of whites to the suburbs, the growth of information service and technology jobs in the suburbs, and the deindustrialization of the urban core increased racial segregation and the concentration of poverty among blacks in major cities. In the mid-1980s, the emergence of a structural underclass, the introduction of crack cocaine into the inner cities, and the proliferation of guns among youthful drug dealers produced a sharp escalation in black youth homicide rates. The age, offense, race-specific increase in youth homicide provided the immediate political context to crack down on youth crime generally. The mass media depict and the public perceive the crime problem and juvenile court's clientele primarily as poor urban black males. Media framing systematically distorts reality, reinforces racial stereotypes, and supports punitive crime policies. Misportraying crime in violent and racial terms activates white's prejudicial stereotypes and reinforces punitive policies. Politicians use crime as a code word for race for electoral advantage with demagogic pledges to crack down on youth crime by demonizing our children and characterizing them as super predators. The intersection of guns, race, and homicide fanned the public panic and the political crackdown that in turn has led to the recent reformulation of juvenile justice jurisprudence, which results both in the transfer of increasing numbers of children to the adult criminal system for criminal prosecution, as well as the increased punitiveness of sentencing in the juvenile justice policy, in the juvenile justice process, both of which have racially disparate consequences. Congress in 1988 reauthorized the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act and mandated states to examine disproportionate minority confinement. 42 of 43 states found racial disparities in pretrial detention, and 15 of 15 states found disproportionate sentencing of racial minorities after controlling for the relevant legal variables. Similarly, criminological research over the past two decades has reported consistently racial disparities, with disparities occurring at various stages of juvenile justice processing, the cumulative effect of racial disparities over the administration of the process, with the net result that minority juveniles now constitute the majority of youths held in juvenile correctional facilities. In a society marked by great inequality, juvenile courts inevitably and necessarily produce racially disparate outcome because the juvenile court itself was designed to discriminate, to distinguish between our children and other people's children. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry Feld. Barry Feld is a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. Before I introduce our final panelists, I want to remind our listeners to tune in to Midday at noon today. We will be live again at the NPR Civic Journalism Summit to hear the keynote speaker, David Cole. He's a First Amendment litigator and a professor at Georgetown University, and he has some interesting ideas about how to reduce racial disparity in our nation's criminal justice systems. Again, that's at noon today. Our fourth and final panelist is B. Todd Jones, a former U.S. attorney for Minnesota. As a federal prosecutor, this former Marine was known for his tough stance on drug traffickers and violent offenders and his interest in protecting public safety and individual rights. B. Todd Jones.
Good morning. As a practitioner within the system, my comments are really one that are directed toward planting the seeds of what I hope will be a good conversation later on and throughout the day. You know, a great Supreme Court jurist once said that the life of the law is not logic, it is experience. And if experience is not always the best teacher, it certainly is the most persuasive. And I think one of the reasons that we're here today is because many of the experiences of persons of color within the criminal justice system have not been one that we as a democratic society necessarily take any pride in. It has fueled deep levels of distrust and cynicism. It has eroded the foundation of our democracy, where equal justice under the law should mean more than just the words. And it has altered our view about what this country really is about. You know, a couple of references have been made today about the events of the last 30 years with respect to how did we get here today. I think that we're more aware of it today because in this fast-paced society, our communication means spread information out at a very rapid pace. But racial profiling is something that didn't just emerge as a result of the war on drugs. Anybody that's a student of American history knows that particularly in African-American communities, racial profiling began the minute the first load of slaves stepped off the ships in 1619. African Americans in particular, Latinos, any community of color has been and hopefully won't always be earmarked within American society because of our tendency to stereotype and desire to put people in the pigeonholes in order to make our decision-making process a little easier. This is amplified when you're talking about the system of public safety, the system of law and order. And I do want to plant the seeds here for some further discussion about my experiences within the system of law and order, because there are various points along the system that racial bias comes into play. Historically, it always has, and unless we take some affirmative action, and as one speaker before we went live said, shift the paradigm, we're always going to be dealing with the system and biases being injected, because the system is us. The system is composed of human beings who make decisions that in isolation may not be caught, may not mean much, but cumulatively has gotten us into the situation where we are today, where there is a vast disparity between who is within the system and who isn't in the system. And I think that there are a couple of different points that we can talk about. First is policing. There are issues that are very prominent in the public debate now regarding policing. We're talking about the broken window syndrome, zero tolerance policing, proactive policing, community policing, because policing is really the first, is the entry point for everyday citizens to get involved in the system. And their involvement in the system is triggered by the decision of a police officer, a representative of the state in the system of law and order, making a decision to bring somebody into the system or not to bring somebody into the system. And as a result, that's a very public and prominent aspect of this debate. And for better or worse, I think that the law enforcement community, police communities, have borne the brunt of a lot of the criticism about racial disparity. And I believe that there's some level of responsibility, but the entire system bears great responsibility for this. And it's unfortunate that given the job police officers have to do, that they're bearing the brunt of the criticism, because those of us within the system know that they have a very, very difficult job to maintain law and order. A second point is prosecution. That's where I have most of my professional experience. And this is sort of the under-the-radar screen point in our system of law and order, because prosecutors make some very important decisions about who to continue through the system. They make decisions about who to prosecute and not prosecute. And there are a lot of different dynamics that I hope we can discuss today about what goes into making that decision by a prosecutor of who to bring before a judge or jury as people proceed through the system. When the prosecutor makes a decision in their discretion about who to bring in and what to charge, in these days where you have mandatory minimum sentencing schemes and truth in sentencing procedure set up and discretion taken away really from the judges and placed more in the prosecutor, that's a critical juncture for what happens to folks further down within the system. The third thing that really hasn't been discussed a lot but is very important in our democracy is our system of trial by jury. There are dynamics at play there that, again, impact the end result with the raw numbers. Everyone has constitutional rights, and a trial by jury is one of those fundamental rights in our system of justice. And in a system of law and order, in the criminal justice system, there are decisions made and biases brought by everyday citizens when they sit on a jury. about who is guilty and who is innocent of a crime that has repercussions within our overall system about who ends up getting convicted and who ends up getting freed. Within this trial by jury system, there's also the question of representation. Very high-profile trials where you get the best representation money can buy, O.J. Simpson being a fine example of that, where the jury system really was a determinant point about what happened. And that did not come at that did not come freely for that defendant in that case. And there are a number of public defenders who work every day within the system who are overwhelmed that try and deal with damage control and sometimes have to make arguments and prepare for as attorneys to represent somebody in front of this trial by jury. Two other points that I think are important. One is sentencing. We have gone through a transformation where basically the discretion of judges in that third branch of government have had a lot of discretion taken away from them because at one point there was a lack of trust in their discretion to sentence fairly, and as a result, we have moved into a system where judges have very little discretion. It's been limited with sentencing guideline processes, and it's been limited with legislative mandates and mandatory minimum sentencing schemes.
We're going to have to stop right there, and hopefully we can get back to that point. Thank you again. That was B. Todd Jones, former U.S. attorney. He's now an attorney in private practice at the law firm of Robbins, Kaplan, Miller, and Cerisi. Again, I'm Brant Williams, broadcasting live from the NPR Civic Journalism Summit, Is There Racial Bias in the Minnesota Criminal Justice System? We have about 70 people and civic leaders involved in the criminal justice system. They're here today at the University of Minnesota Law School to discuss where bias might exist and how it might be eradicated. Leonard Witt and Ken Darling are out in the aisles here at the law school to get your questions and comments on the air. If you have something to say, just get their attention and they'll bring the mic over to you. Please, again, keep your comments brief so we can hear from as many of you as possible. Len, somebody over there.
Yeah, I'm with Dan Kane. He's president of the RS Eden programs. Dan.
Well, first I'd like to thank the panelists, but I need to say that one of the problems with being old is you see things several different times in different shapes and form, and I'm a little bit offended that we're still asking this question, is there racial disparity in the criminal justice system? I was around when we asked the question in 93 with the Supreme Court study. I was around when we did things with the Byrne Commission, around again today, and it seems to me that the question has been asked, it's been answered, the answer is absolutely, unequivocally, case closed, you know, but we don't like the answer, so we keep asking the question, which I think is frankly stupid. At every stage of the system where there is subjectivity in the decision-making process, people of color suffer. From the decision to stop, to the decision to arrest, to the decision to prosecute, to the decision to bargain, to the decision to sentence. And I will say Minnesota is a little bit ahead of the game in that I don't think there's much disparity in the decision to release. But there's disparity everywhere that it's subjective. And I would offer to you an example of where that disparity exists, or where that, and I would even use the R word, racism, that we don't like to use and that we run from in Minnesota. We don't like to think of ourselves as racist. I have a biracial grandson. My daughter is a single parent. My grandson's father is a deadbeat. He's not around. He's been to jail on cocaine charges. He's absent from the family. He doesn't pay any child support. He's basically a bum. I would bet that there isn't one person in this room, when I describe that, who came to the conclusion that my daughter could be biracial and my grandson's father could be white.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your comments. Any of our panelists like to respond? I mean, is this it's a moot point? As he said, this is almost insulting to ask the question. Why is it important that we keep this dialogue going?
Well, Mark, now let me just offer. I don't necessarily disagree with your analysis of the system. It seems to me that, you know, the intriguing, difficult questions are, you know, how do these disparities persist? You know, the fact that we do have more people of color in decision-making positions in the system? How does that affect how decisions are made? The fact that you point out that when subjectivity is in the system, that leads to disparity. We also know, as we've heard, in the federal guideline system and some other systems of mandatory sentencing where you supposedly take away discretion, we still see some of those same disparities emerging too, or transfer of discretion and decision-making. So I think if we're going to answer the question, come up with some solutions, yes, disparities still exist, and we should stop asking that question, but how they exist, why they exist, that's the challenging part of it, it seems to me.
Thanks. That was Mark Maurer. Ken Darling, you have somebody with a question?
Yeah, we do. Nancy Lee is the Vice President of Housing Services for the Central Community Housing Trust in Minneapolis. Nancy?
I appreciate the fact that all of the panelists really speak to something that I think we need to address here today in our small groups, and that is the human component, that whether you're a police officer or a judge or any of the various positions that will affect what happens to an individual, there is personal, individual concerns that come up. So I'm hoping that we could do a paradigm shift again and look at not how we affect, not only how we affect like pretrial and prosecution and probation and jail, but how can we affect how we choose judges or police, how can we affect inside the community placing funds that really assist people in improving their lives so there's no need to have criminal activity in order for them to sustain a livelihood or to move forward in their lives. So I'd like to move, I hope, our conversations around that issue as well, the broader effects that the society have on this issue.
Thank you very much. Any of the panelists like to comment to that? Or John Powell?
I have a brief comment. I certainly agree with what the speaker just said, but there's a kernel in it that I think is important to lift up and challenge. And that is that a lot of the disparities is not because of criminal activity. So it's not simply if we can get the minority community to not engage in criminal activity. If you do a survey of African Americans, especially African American males, you find that close to 50% have been stopped by the police. That's not because of criminal activity they've engaged in. To some extent, I think our inability to make change is our inability to basically disrupt or make someone uncomfortable. So, for example, when we talk about dealing with racial profiling, the issues shift from the needs of the community to the needs of the police, the needs of the larger wider community. In essence, we basically make the needs of the community that we're concerned about the least important in these discussions. And just one last thing, in terms of minorities being in positions of power and authority within the system, my sense is that that's very limited. They don't have the ability to make the kind of structural changes that we really want. So, for example, when we look at police officers, black police officers have been very strong in terms of supporting collecting data around racial profiling, but they haven't been able to carry the day oftentimes in charging a larger police force.
Thank you. Thank you very much, John Powell. Len Witt has somebody with a question.
Yeah, I'm with Gregory Hessness, who's deputy chief of the Minneapolis Police Department.
Thank you, sir. I think what we have here is a rare opportunity, and I say it for this, as you mentioned, how long we've been in the system. I'm experiencing my 26th year here, and in the last 4 or 5 years, we've had about a 43% reduction in Part 1 crime in the city of Minneapolis. And being community policing driven 4 or 5 years ago, and we're at the peak of our violent crimes in Minneapolis, the community was not demanding we look at racial profiling or racism. They were demanding that we do something about the violent crime. I think it's really important that at this point we take advantage of the improvements in the crime picture we've had to really have this dialogue, because having seen this for 26 years, if we have another upsurge, this will drop on the radar screen.
Thank you, Greg Hegness. We have a comment from Barry Feld.
I think it's important to talk about what the public demands and what the public perceives in terms of the prevalence of violent crime, because even though we have seen, and congratulations, this wonderful drop in violent crime, if you ask the average person in the street, what's crime look like today? And they'll tell you it's violent and it's black, because the media are disproportionately depicting violent crime out of the universe of crime, and they're disproportionately depicting minority offenders as perpetrators and whites as victims, even though most crime is intra-racial. And so there is a perception of crime out there that's very different from the reality of the experience of crime. And it's important to emphasize the extent to which politicians themselves use crime, and police use crime, for budgetary reasons. Politicians use it for political advantage. And the issues we're talking about, crime, are really a social problem, and there are lots of different ways of responding to it as a social problem, and law enforcement and punitive policies are only one of a large array of social policy and legal policy alternatives to deal with the same problem of crime in the street.
Thank you, Barry Feld. I just want to remind our listeners that you can join the statewide discussion on the Internet by clicking on the soapbox at minnesotapublicradio.org. We want to hear what you have to say. And coming up at noon today, the keynote address by David Cole of Georgetown University. We have a question. Andrew Argenbrett, you have somebody here for us?
Thanks, Brent. I'm here with John Stewart, a public defender from Minnesota State Public Defender's Office.
Thank you. I agree with Dan Kane that the question is not, is there racial bias in the system? The question is, what should we do about it? And that's a question that public defenders face every day. I'd like the listeners to know that we're committed in Minnesota to have a top-quality public defender system. We are also 500% more diverse than the legal profession as a whole in the state of Minnesota, and we're bringing test cases about racial profiling and racial bias in every part of the state right now. So I hope people that are thinking about these issues will see public defense as a community resource. We don't always have the funding and the strength that we need to solve these problems, but we're out there working to be part of the solution.
Thank you, John Stewart. Mark Maurer, you mentioned the public defense as an important part of the system and maybe doesn't get the kind of funding as prosecution. Is that kind of the case around the country?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you've got problems in Minnesota with public defense, but, you know, compared to many places in the country, it seems like heaven, I'm sure, if you look at sort of the pay and the caseloads in places like Louisiana and Kentucky and elsewhere. And, you know, as we pointed out before, you know, you look at the O.J. Simpson case is probably the model. You know, we probably have a variety of opinions in the room about guilt and innocence in that case, but I think what was quite crystal clear was that he had a world-class defense, which he was entirely entitled to provide, and I think there's very little doubt that had he had an overworked public defender or assigned counsel in a small town somewhere, we would have seen a very different outcome, you know, regardless of what the guilt or innocence actually was. So I think this is really key to what the outcomes of many of these cases ends up looking like.
Thank you, Mark Maurer. We have another question. Ken Darling, you have somebody there?
Yeah, we have Michael Jordan, former commissioner of public safety, now with the St. Paul Police. Michael?
I'd like to ask the panel to give some consideration to the notion of why don't we have an opportunity to make this change? John Powell mentioned that almost a decade ago, the state Supreme Court offered many recommendations to affect some change in the disparity, the potential bias. 90% of those recommendations were implemented, and yet the problem has worsened in severity, not decreased. Why do you think that we've been unable to make the system change, that the people within the system will not make it change to where this bias can be removed?
Thank you.
Well, two things. One, I think we have made some change, although I think oftentimes we're more concerned with process than with results. And sometimes we adopt process as a way of avoiding adopting real change. We adopt a fancy procedure that will maintain the status quo. And this is not just in terms of the criminal justice system. If we look at our schools, there was a case in 1969 dealing with segregation in the Minneapolis schools. The schools are now more segregated than they were then. And that's not just true in Minneapolis, it's true across the country. In 1968, Walter Mondale introduced a fair housing bill that basically said it's not right to say people can't live someplace because of their race. we are essentially as segregated today with minor decline as we were in 1968. So as we go across each area, we find out that we've adopted procedures and policies that in some cases are designed in terms of the implementation not to create the real change that we want. And one of the reasons is that sometimes the change basically means that some population, and frankly often white populations, will be made uncomfortable. And so we're willing to do something as long as it doesn't cost anybody anything. So when we talk about racial profiling, for example, we hear arguments that it's going to be inconvenient to the police to actually collect this data. Well, any change is going to create inconvenience for someone. And as a society, we have not been willing to really take that on.
Thank you, John Powell. Barry Feld, you have a comment on that?
Yeah, the issues of racial bias are really structural rather than procedural. They're really rooted in political economy and the distribution of resources in American society and in our unwillingness to address the fact that the U.S., of every Western industrial democracy, has the greatest inequality of wealth and income, and particularly with respect to people of color, so that our public policies would really require us to confront very frontally much, much larger issues about power and about allocation of resources, and that's why we fund public education the way we do, locally rather than at the state level, because we want to invest in our own children, but we don't want to invest in other people's children. You know, so that the question you're really asking is not about ameliorative tinkering, it's about the fundamental distribution of wealth and power in American society.
Thank you, Barry Feld. We have one more comment from the, and then we're going to go to a question. Todd Jones.
One brief comment here, because as I look around the room, there are a lot of folks that serve in various public service capacities in the executive branch of government, and there are judges here, and what Professor Feld just talked about and a frustration for me is the politicization of crime and the inability of our legislative branch of government to deal with some of these issues in a forthright and objective way, because in the executive branch, our resources really are driven by the fiscal process and what the legislators, both in Minnesota and in Washington, D.C., decide what are priorities and what they're going to devote resources to.
Thank you, Todd Jones. Andrew, you have someone with a question there.
Yes, Brent, this is Gordon Stewart, Executive Director for the Legal Rights Center, a criminal defense law firm of people of color.
Thank you very much. I want to give you an illustration of the intersection between race and class as it actually occurs in the juvenile justice system. I am not an attorney. I am the Executive Director of the Legal Rights Center. When I first arrived there, I was invited by the Chief judge in juvenile court in Hennepin County to sit with him on the bench to observe the status calendar, which is the calendar for juveniles whose offense is an offense by virtue of age, that they're smoking and they're drinking or whatever. What I observed caught me by surprise. Those kids who were from the western suburbs, almost all of them white, 98% of them white, were invited to leave the courtroom and to meet with a representative of a suburban diversion program in the hallway. And when they came back, they were represented. They had a staff person with them. Those who were left in the courtroom were Minneapolis kids who were almost all people of color, largely African American.
Thank you. I'm going to have to stop you right there. We want to get to maybe just a couple more questions before we have to end this segment. Maybe I'll just go straight to Len, who's got another person who wants to comment.
Yeah, I'm with Vivian Jenkins-Nelson. She's president of Interrace Institute.
I'd like the panel to approach the question of the effects of racial disparity in plea bargaining and how we can approach changing that.
Anyone on the panel like to comment on that, plea bargaining?
Well, Mark Maurer, let me just say it's the great hidden aspect of the criminal justice system, about which we know very little. We suspect we have some idea what's going on there. Prosecutors are not exactly very open or receptive to the idea of looking at their records and looking at their statistics and things like that. We've seen a whole movement in recent years focused on law enforcement and the issue of racial profiling. People are now starting to begin to think of, since prosecutors play such a key role in the system, to what extent should we be examining some of those decisions? Now, clearly, we can't always know everything that's going on in minds. Every case has, dozens of different variables, but the overall patterns, there's at least some research to suggest that in some kinds of cases, prosecutors may offer white defendants a more favorable plea bargain than for people of color, and I think that's a very critical area that we now need to begin to examine as well.
Thank you, Mark. I think we're going to have time for about one more comment, probably. Ken, you have somebody there?
Yeah, Jay Bryson is with Insight News, an African-American paper in the Twin Cities. Jay?
Thank you. Deputy Chief Ennis had mentioned earlier that this was a situation that could have fallen off the radar, or that was off the radar screens during a high crime period in Minneapolis. Well, I take exception to that because in the African-American community, we don't have the luxury of making others of criminal perpetrators, and because of the realities of the criminal justice system, we have to have a balance in our perceptions of crime. Mr. Ennis suggested that during a spike in criminal behavior, arrests, etc., concern about disparities would fall off. Well, not in our community. At Insight, during that period, we ran stories not only about the rising murder rates, but stories about, for example, Theodore Bobo, who was mentally ill and was shot to death by police officers. In our community, I think we have to have that balance, and we're never, ever able to let go of that.
Thank you. I think that's going to have to be our last comment here. We're going to have to wrap things up. It's getting towards the end of the hour. Again, I'm NPR reporter Brant Williams, and I'm your host from the NPR Civic Journalism Summit entitled, Is There Racial Bias in the Minnesota Criminal Justice System? Be sure to tune in to the summit again today at noon on all on all NPR news and information stations to hear the keynote address by Georgetown University's David Cole. This summit is sponsored by the Minnesota Public Radio Civic Journalism Initiative, the Institute on Criminal Justice, and the Minnesota Journalism Center. Thanks to Leonard Witt, Executive Director of the NPR Civic Journalism Initiative, Heather Ford, Lindsey Brown, Richard Fraze, Janet Wigg, Ken Darling, Sherry Mazingo, and Kathleen Hansen for developing the summit format. The NPR broadcast producer is Sarah Meyer, and assistant producer is Kara Figenshue. Scott Liebers and Alan Strickland are the technical directors, and we had online support from Phil Bilodeau and Michael Wells of NPR. Special thanks to Gary Mueller-Liley and Marty Busman. If you missed any of this broadcast or have some ideas about this issue, log on to minnesotapublicradio.org. Again, I'm your NPR host, Brant Williams, broadcasting live from the University of Minnesota Law School. Remember to tune in again at noon for more discussion on race and crime in Minnesota. Thank you.
Minnesota Public Radio's reports on racial disparity in the criminal justice system are supported in part by the Minneapolis Foundation, a center for giving, connecting resources with opportunities to benefit Minnesota. I'm Catherine Landry. You are listening to a very special edition of Mid-Morning. We just finished with a special panel of experts over at the University of Minnesota, where they're having a special day-long summit on racial bias in the Minnesota criminal justice system. And as reporter Brant Williams reminded you, we'll have more on that at noon when we hear from David Cole, a Georgetown University law professor, the author of No Equal Justice. Now, a few minutes after 10 here on Mid-Morning, you're going to be hearing about real estate. We know that we have the tightest housing market in the nation. So it's hard enough to buy your first house. How do you find your way in the roughest place in the nation? Well, you'll find out a few minutes after 10. And then, as I said earlier, we'll go over to midday. Mike Mulcahy is standing in today for Gary Eichten.
Good morning, Catherine. Glad to be here. Coming up at midday at 11 o'clock, we're going to be talking with Christine Jacks. She is the commissioner of the State Department of Children, Families, and Learning. And now that everybody's out of school, starting summer vacation, we thought it'd be a good time to have her come in and talk a little bit.